Welcome to Homefront on Missouri Grassroots Radio. I'm Cynthia Davis, your host. As a writer, speaker, and former legislator, we discuss limiting government, fiscal responsibility, and fair taxation. I'm a mother of seven and a wife of one for over three decades, so I bring you my personal experience. And now it's time for Homefront with Cynthia Davis. Thank you for joining us on Homefront today. We have Michael Ferris. He is the Chancellor of the Patrick Henry College and Chairman of the Homeschool Legal Defense Association. He was the founding president of both organizations. Ferris graduated magna cum laude with a degree in political science from the Western Washington University. He received a law degree and graduated with honors from Gonzaga University School of Law in Spokane, Washington. Ferris received an international law degree from the University of London. He married in 1971 and has 10 children and 17 grandchildren. He and his wife, Vicki, began homeschooling in 1982, an activity which led him to establish the Homeschool Legal Defense Association in 1983. Welcome, Michael Ferris.
Thank you, Cynthia. It's good to be with you.
It's a thrill to have you on our show. I guess reading your biography, I couldn't help but feel like you're an overachiever.
Well, yeah, I guess people react. The thing of all those things is the 10 kids that get people's attention. And justifiably, my wife has been doing the lion's share of the work in homeschooling our kids. I'm happy to be helpful to her in that regard and to lead our family in that regard. But really, we're most proud of our kids.
Well, you've got me beat having 10 children. I only have 7, but we're both tied for having one spouse.
That's right, exactly.
You know, it's very common when I tell people I have 7 children, they imagine how many are mine and how many are my husband's. And
right.
So I've gone to having to explain that they're 7 children with the same mom and dad.
Yeah, well, there you go. Yeah, I've got that same question. It's more common that these days than thinking you're Mormon or Catholic.
Yeah. So you started off in Spokane, Washington. I have some very good friends in Spokane. It's a very special, bright spot in the country. But were you born there, or what took you there?
No, I was born in Arkansas. But we left Arkansas when I was 3 years old and went to Washington State. And I grew up in a town southwest of Spokane, about a couple of hours away, called Kennewick. And I grew up in Kennewick and went to college in 3 different places in Washington State, at Whitman College in Walla Walla, then graduated from Western in Bellingham, and then went to Gonzaga Law School.
So is that where you met your wife?
We met on the first day of college at Whitman College in Walla Walla, and we didn't really start dating on the first day, but we started dating on the first day of the second semester. And we got married between our sophomore and junior years of college, which is one of the reasons we transferred. We were at a private school, which is pretty expensive for a young married couple. We transferred and went to a state school and graduated from that state school with her degree in elementary education and my degree in political science.
And it was a Catholic school you went to. I was going to guess if you were Catholic until I read that you were actually an ordained Baptist minister. So how did that happen?
Well, there's just 3 law schools in Washington State, and one of them is a Catholic school, and it wasn't a particularly Catholic school, the law school at least. In practice, it was a very secular school.
That's okay. So what took you away from Spokane, and how did you end up in Virginia?
Well, I started the Moral Majority of Washington State back in 1980, and I moved from Spokane to Olympia to run the state Moral Majority chapter. And along the lines of doing that, I met Tim and Bev LaHaye. And Tim and Bev hired me to be The National Field Director for Concerned Women for America, which was an interesting thing, having a man do that. But shortly after that, they decided to open a Washington, D.C. office and put me in charge of that office for them. And so I moved to the D.C. area, lived in Virginia in the 1983. And I was also with the LaHayes physically, with them doing... they were doing a television show, and I was assisting them. I was basically full-time staff counsel for them at this point in time. And they had a man on the show talk about homeschooling, and he cornered me, and also their daughter was about my age, and talked both of us, and we both went home to our respective spouses and talked them into homeschooling our kids. And so the LaHayes were my conduit to both Washington, D.C., and homeschooling, and I worked closely with Tim and Bev for 6 years, and they remained very close friends, and that's how I got to D.C., is to run the D.C. office for Concerned Women for America as their head lobbyist and head litigator.
That's pretty exciting. And then in 1993, you won the Republican nomination for Lieutenant Governor of Virginia. And according to your Wikipedia article, it says that you went on to lose the general election to the Democrat. And they go into explaining why they think you lost. Wikipedia claims that your friendships with conservative leaders like Jerry Falwell, Pat Robertson, Phyllis Schlafly, and your adherence to the Quiverful movement stirred up some nasty ads, and you were unable to overcome those negative odds. Well, here in Missouri, 2012, we had a similar situation with Todd Akin getting pummeled by his own party. And then when I read that even Republican senators would turn their back on you, I'm so sad by the climate. Can you explain what kind of country are we living in now where even the Republicans don't stay with conservatives, but they when they put a moderate up, then they say we have to all stay together?
I'd be happy to do that. I just need to say, since you were using Wikipedia, I do need to correct one thing. I am friends with all those people that they said, well, of course, Jerry Falwell's gone to heaven, but all those other people have been my friends. Some are closer friends than others. I'm not ever been particularly close with Pat Robertson, for example, but I've never been associated with the Quiverful movement. Just because I have 10 kids, people make that assumption, but that's just, there's a certain philosophy that goes with that I don't agree with, and so we just love kids, and so God's blessed us with 10, and that's pretty much all that's relevant here. But what's wrong with our country is pretty complex, but the easiest way to boil it down to is this, is there's two philosophies of what's the purpose of government. One group believes that the purpose of government is to provide for my needs. The other group believes that the purpose of government is to protect life, liberty, and property and to punish those who do evil. Now, I'm in the group that believes the second thing, that we have a limited purpose of government, really to protect liberty and life and to make sure that evil doesn't erupt. And that, you know, that's why we have police, that's why we have the army, and so on. We have a nation that is growing to believe in the principles of socialism. And socialism is the result of believing that the purpose of government is to provide for our needs. And Washington, D.C., really is ingrained in the providing for our needs philosophy, both the Republicans and the Democrats. And so when a Republican comes along and actually believes that we shouldn't have a government providing for everyone's needs, that we really should be in the business just simply of protecting life, liberty, and property, and have very limited interventions that in terms of providing for people's needs, mainly because we've made people promises and we really shouldn't change our promises midstream. But other than that, you know, it's liberty versus big government, and I'm on the liberty side of that, and I'm on the morality side of it, and they're on the immorality side of it. And you know, they don't fight fair, and I came very close. I got 46% of the vote against the incumbent, and have been asked to run for other offices including people have asked me to run for the U.S. Senate this coming time in 14 in Virginia. But so far, God hasn't opened that door in my life and has called me to do other things, even though I'm very interested and very involved in politics, as I'm sure will develop.
Well, and that's critical, because without good people in office, it discourages the constituents sitting at home knowing that there's no hope that we'll get good people. On the other hand, when you see good people put their name on the ballot and then get sabotaged by their own party and people who are supposed to be rallying together, people who claim to be conservative, people who claim to be in favor of limited government, and then we're watching the government grow bigger every year. We're watching the budget grow bigger every year, and we're watching government become more intrusive into families every year. And there's a point where we have to blame ourselves for electing these people. How does that happen?
Well, that happens because parents and pastors don't train their children and their congregation in the principles of freedom. It's as simple as that. And one of my favorite founders is not very well known. His name is George Nicholas. He was a hero. He actually shot the first bullets at the British when they dared to invade the Commonwealth of Virginia. And he was a delegate to the Virginia Constitutional Ratification Convention. And he was in a debate with Patrick Henry over whether the Constitution was going to be safe or not. And he said, George Nicholas said, that enlightened people would never allow the Constitution, which is intended for our good, to become an instrument of tyranny. Unfortunately, the government that we have that claims to be operating under the Constitution really has become an instrument of tyranny. And the reason is because we didn't live up to Nicholas's standard. We haven't been enlightened people. That is, we don't know really what's going on. We don't know what government is supposed to do, and we don't do anything about it. And so what I have been felt called to do for really a little more than 30 years is to help wake up people and show them what the principles of freedom are, both from the Word of God and from the Constitution, to encourage parents to ensure that they train their kids. Now, obviously, I'm a big fan of homeschooling as a really probably the best way, in my opinion, of doing it. It's not the only way, but all parents need to be making sure that they are training their kids in the principles of freedom and to, you know both the Word of God and the Constitution. And, you know, that's why I started Patrick Henry College. It really is to start, you know, is to put the top end of the leadership into place. The homeschooling movement helps supply a lot of the grassroots forces. And I'm working political projects now to try to reclaim the freedom of this country. And if we, you know, it's a comprehensive battlefront, but God's allowed me to be involved in several phases of that battle. And I'm just really have believed for a long time that the job of my generation is to hold on to freedom just long enough so that we get the next generation trained in the principles of freedom and launch them onto the battlefield and let them take the land. I call it the Joshua generation idea. We're the Moses generation. We're the ones that say we're not going to do it Egypt's way anymore. We're going to walk toward freedom. But it's really going to be the second generation, I think, that's going to take us all the way and deliver the actual freedom that our country needs.
I love that idea, and I'll just explain my own experience. When I was in the Missouri State Legislature trying to push the parental rights law in our state, I filed it both as a House Joint Resolution, which could have gone into the Constitution, and as a law that would go into our statutes. But the problem I had, even though I got a commitment from leadership that it would go to the floor, and I chaired the Children and Families Committee so I could make sure I made it a priority bill, but I couldn't even get enough Republicans to work with me on the idea that parents should have rights to raise their children. The common pushback we got from everybody was, well, what about all those lousy parents who abuse their kids? And why would, of course, we already have laws that say you're not allowed to hurt your children. So we really have a steep learning curve when you end up with a society where people trust that government will be the savior of the children more than the parents. When we get to a perverse philosophical position that is premised upon the fact that parents are not the chief guardian of the children, but the state is, then we've got huge problems. And if we couldn't get that passed in a freedom-loving state like Missouri, it brings out a negative opportunity for it to pass anywhere else in the country. What do you think about that? Are you seeing it succeed anywhere?
We passed last year. That almost identical bill became law in Virginia and in Nevada. We wrote the law and worked with the legislators there and made it happen, and we got very close in a couple of other states, and we think we're going to see in this session more states pass that law. Part of this is an educational process. What we need to understand that a parental rights law does, it's like a freedom of speech law. It never means that parents have absolute rights. It just simply assigns the burden of proof. That's what it really does. And it says what the burden of proof is and who has to prove it. The way we're operating right now is that the burden of proof is on parents who want to make decisions for their kids. They got to show why the government is wrong. And that's not the way it should be. It should be the other way around. If the government wants to intervene in our life and say that we're doing the wrong thing with our kids, there should be a high standard of proof, and the burden should be on the government. That's the result of saying that the right of parents to direct the upbringing and education of their children is a fundamental right. That's what all those words mean. And if the legislators, even with their staff counsel, if they're not all lawyers, they should be able to figure that out. It's not that complicated. But some of them are just, think that there are other things that are so important, they don't even take the time to read a couple of three pages about it to understand the issue. And others are, simply they love big government. And so we need to either educate those that are willing to be educated, and we need to replace those that aren't willing to be educated with people who believe that parents should, we should start off with a presumption that parents are good. And if we're going to presume that government's good instead, A, we're not really a freedom-loving people, and B, we don't know much about common sense. Because the vast majority of parents do the right thing with their kids. They're not abusing their kids. They're not harming their kids. Sure, some people do, and the law is written for that, and parental rights statutes would not stop that. It would just make sure that the burden of proof is correctly assigned. You've got to prove that people are abusing their kids, not just assume it.
Right, that's good. And, of course, when we were debating these questions, all the opposition was bringing up was anecdotal stories about how somebody one time hurt their child, and under this it would give parents rights who are in prison. And, it just became absurd, because you can't fight with logic when you're arguing with people who are using stories.
Right. There's a saying in politics, actually, Senator Daniel Moynihan said it, that at least that's the one I give credit to, is that everybody's entitled to their own opinion, but they're not entitled to their own facts. And for anybody to claim that this would give superior rights to parents who are in prison, they just don't know the facts. They don't know what, we use very carefully chosen legal terms of art. And if they aren't willing to pass parental rights legislation that has been very carefully drafted using well-recognized phrases that have long litigation history behind them, and we know what these things mean, then they're just willfully ignorant. And either that or they're just demagogues, and they say whatever they want to say without having any need to think that it's truthful. We don't need leaders like that. We need leaders who are diligent enough to learn what the truth is and are courageous enough to stand up for the principles of freedom.
One more question I'll ask you about that, because I've been wondering for all this time, is we have seen so many families break up. We've seen so many parents never even marry each other in the first place. And so one of the questions we were asked is, if there was a conflict between one parent said this and the other parent says that, how do we make sense on who gets to be the parent who has the right to say?
Well, family law governs that right now, and that would not change under the law, because what people who ask that question don't seem to realize is what the nature of a constitutional provision is, or a provision like this, that when it talks about fundamental rights. rights language, whether it's in statute or in the Constitution, says what the government can or cannot do. It doesn't settle disputes between private parties. So if you've got mom battling dad in a custody dispute or in some other context, some family law dispute, family law is going to govern that. Constitutional law governs when your dispute is with the government itself, when the government's trying to intrude. So the answer is, this isn't relevant to that. That's another section of law. That's family law, and we've already allocated those rules, and they're pretty well known, and maybe they're right, maybe they're wrong, but you tweak family law. You don't mess with constitutional law to fix those problems, and you don't lack the common knowledge of basic law. The first day of law, con law class, that when I teach it at Patrick Henry College, is the Constitution binds the government. That's it. It binds the government. It's a law for the government. And so these people just simply need to come and at least take one day of con law from me at Patrick Henry College. If they don't know that much, they really shouldn't be in the legislature.
There are plenty of people who I concur should not be in the legislature. But yet we have who we have to work with. And they're the ones who are in a very dangerous position because they're passing laws every day, taking away our freedom. Hi friends, do you like what you're hearing? Then go to my website. It's CynthiaDavis.net and sign up for my newsletter. You'll get all this information and more when you sign up for my email reminding you of when you'll hear another podcast and letting you know what's coming up next. Besides, we always have a little bit of humor at the end, so go to CynthiaDavis.net and stay in the loop. For those of you who don't like email, go to my Facebook page. It's called Homefront with Cynthia Davis. And make sure you click the like button. That way, you'll have a convenient way to see what we're doing and to get the word when another podcast is released. That's Homefront with Cynthia Davis on Facebook. My website is CynthiaDavis.net. That's where we keep all our good stuff. So if you want to get our newsletter and find more podcasts, go to CynthiaDavis.net. Hey, let's stay in touch. Looking at the direction the country is going, what prompted you to get involved with the idea of the Convention of States? Can you explain that story to us?
Sure. I have been, trying my best in a variety of ways, I think it's apparent by now, to try to preserve liberty in this country for more than 30 years. And I've run for office, I've lobbied, I've litigated, I've raised grassroots troops, I've done all kinds of things. And I'm absolutely convinced of one central premise, and it was after the last election, where the combination of big cities, big government, and big media combined to reelect Barack Obama. And I said, we're never going to fix the problems that are arising out of Washington, D.C., as long as we battle on the turf of big cities, big government, and big media. It's not going to work. Those people will kill us in that venue. We've got to fight where we've got the troops, where we've got the odds in our favor, and that is in state legislatures. And the Founding Fathers gave us the perfect vehicle to fix the problems in Washington, D.C. In Article 5 of the Constitution, it allows the states unilaterally to put structural changes into the Constitution whenever they believe that the federal government's out of control. And if people don't understand the federal government's out of control, they haven't read a newspaper in 20 years. With the debt crippling us, it's a lot bigger than $17 trillion. That's the amount that we recognize. The accrued liabilities for all the pension plans and the Social Security and Medicare, take that number much higher, probably as high as $100 million or maybe even $100 trillion or $200 trillion. And so, and the NSA spying on citizens and judges saying it's okay, and the federal government reaching into every aspect of our lives, the federal government is utterly determined to destroy liberty in this country, and nothing that will happen in Washington, D.C. is going to stop it. The only thing that can stop it is the states themselves. The states, under Article 5, can call a convention of the states. A simple majority in 34 states call a convention of the states. A simple majority of the legislature in 34 states call a convention of the states, and at that convention, they can propose amendments that are in accord with the subject matter of the call. And the states write the call, and then the states write the amendments according to the call. The call that I'm pursuing, in short terms, says we want to rein in the power of Washington, D.C. To be very precise, it says that we're going to impose fiscal restraints on the federal government, we're going to reduce the jurisdiction of the federal government, and we're going to impose term limits on federal officials, which would mean really judges and members of Congress, not just the president. And so we're about that business right now, and I'm leading conventionofthestates.com is the website for it, and it just so happens that a guy named Mark Levin came up with the exact same idea that I did. My website launched about 10 days before his book came out, and we didn't know each other was working on the same thing. We're now working side by side trying to make this happen, but I view it as God's intervention for our country that Mark Levin came forward and really pushed the project forward very rapidly in a very short period of time.
And I agree with you that the convention of the states makes sense in a theoretical and pragmatic world. I believe the people who are opposed to the idea have a more cynical view of government and do not believe that our leaders are capable, even on the state level, of coming up with good legislation that they can agree on. And think about this, for example. Common Core was supposed to be such a bad idea for conservatives, and yet now we've got conservatives who are confused and some are supporting Common Core. You've got a majority of the states that have agreed to Common Core standards. How are we going to fight bigger government and bad ideas when even something that should be a no-brainer like that is passing?
Well, Common Core is a very perfect example because we really have two choices: give up or use the convention of the states. There is no other alternative that I know of, because what's made Common Core possible is federal funding. The federal government steals money from the taxpayers in the states. Actually, more precisely, they steal money from the grandchildren yet to be born, and called borrowed funds, and they dangle it out as a bribe to the states and say, we will give you X number of millions of dollars each state if you will adopt this Common Core stuff. And so the states, being bribed with the taxpayers' own money, do what the bribers want them to do. Well, what you need to do is take away the power of the federal government to bribe anybody. And the way that they have done that is by a misuse of the General Welfare Clause. And so you amend the General Welfare Clause so that they can't do that. And it's very simple to say, and the language would be something like this. The federal government cannot spend money on any subject matter within the competence of the states. So the states, obviously, education is within the competence of the states. So therefore, the federal government can't spend money on that, period. And if they can't spend money on it, they can't bribe it, and they don't get the state legislators. The problem with the process is the legislators don't care what the voters say because they care what the money says, and the money comes from people other than the voters. It comes from the federal government. And so we've got to break that cycle, and it's a structural change that's needed there. And if we make that structural change, that's possible. Now, the states on their own, the legislators, because they hate mandates. You're in the legislature. Mm-hmm. They hate these unfunded mandates, and you really don't like the funded mandates because they always start out funded, and then they take away more and more of the funding and leave you with a dribble of funding, and the mandate still stays in place. So the states know that this is a corrupt system, but they're addicted to the money. And so you take away the money. You gotta have a structural solution to the problem. And so, we either give up or we use common sense in the Founding Fathers plan to bring a structural solution. And I'm in favor of doing something rather than giving up. And the thing I want to do is the very thing that the Founding Fathers gave us. George Mason said that the reason he put this in Article 5 is because there was going to be a day that the federal government was too big for its britches. I'm paraphrasing, obviously. And that when that day comes, the states need the ability to unilaterally amend the Constitution to bring structural control back against the federal government. And that's what we're doing.
Is it possible that the states could make it worse if they get together?
No, they can either they'll either fail or they'll make it better. It is possible that it'll fail. And then we're back to the doing nothing scenario. But I don't think it's likely that we're going to fail. I think it's far more likely that we're going to pass. Now, whether we would succeed on everything, that I can't promise. But I believe that we will see. I think we'll see a balanced budget requirement of the federal government. I think you're going to see changes to the General Welfare Clause and the Commerce Clause. The General Welfare Clause, by the way, is exactly how we got Obamacare. It's the same thing. They misread the General Welfare Clause to give us Obamacare. People thought they were going to misread the Commerce Clause, but turned out, no, they didn't misread the Commerce Clause. They misread the General Welfare Clause and gave us Obamacare as a tax. Well, we can fix that. I mean, that is a structural change. We need to take away the power of Congress to do this. We also need to take away the power of the federal courts to run our lives in the way that they've been doing. And my suggestion for how we're going to do this at the Convention of the States is, these federal judges love international law. Yeah, okay. We're going to hoist them on their own petard. The Court of European Court of Human Rights has 46 countries that are members of that court. And every country appoints their own judge. And I believe that the Supreme Court of the United States should be composed of 50 judges, just like that court's composed of 46 judges. They take turns in sitting on some cases, and in other cases, they don't all physically sit on the bench when the case is heard, but they all participate in the decision through the briefs and the written opinions. And we can do that in the Supreme Court of the United States as well. Every state should appoint one judge to the Supreme Court for 6 or 8 years or something like that, and you rotate them kind of like we do the Senate, so they're not all coming on or going off at the same time. And Supreme Court isn't a friend of the Constitution because its power comes from Washington, D.C. And we need to make sure that the power no longer comes from Washington, D.C., but comes from the states. That will ensure the independence of the Supreme Court better than anything we can possibly do. We need to take it away from being a part of the Washington, D.C. cabal. And that's possible. That kind of structural change is never going to be possible proposing that in Congress. It is possible when you take it through the state method of the Convention of the States.
Yeah, my congressman for many years was Todd Akin, and he explained to me that the reason Congress never got fixed when they could have corrected themselves. There was a time when they had a majority of Republicans in the House and Senate, and they didn't ever change the structure to make sure the rules were set up to be fair. And then when the Democrats became in charge, they took advantage of those rules and used it in a way that would make sure that fair market, free market people wouldn't, and ideas wouldn't get across. And so now we're kind of stumped with, they wanted the structure to be perverted because that allows the bad guys to win every time. And here we are asking the same question, is it possible to change the structure without collapsing the scaffolding?
Well, the reality is the scaffolding has collapsed. Our federal government is broken, totally broken. We don't think that it's broken when a government spies on its own citizens. Every citizen, they're reading all of our emails, they're listening to all of our cell phone conversations. And the federal judges are saying, that's okay, that complies with the Constitution. We have the taxation, we have the debt, we have the intrusion in our life. They're telling us what medical care we have to have. They're telling us what doctor we have to have. And we still believe the scaffolding is up and working. It's not working. It's broken. And it's just going, any semblance of liberty that's left is so scant that we don't even recognize what it is to be a free people anymore. We shouldn't be afraid of the Internal Revenue Service. Government should fear the people. fear of the government. And we walk in fear of our government. We walk in fear of the IRS. We walk in fear of the NSA. We walk in fear of political retaliation. We walk, you know, we shouldn't be that way. We're not, when you're walking in fear, you're not a free people. And we need to fix that. And there's only one way to structurally fix it that's within the Constitution, and that is the Convention of the States. Otherwise, the only other alternative is armed revolution, and nobody sensible wants that.
I don't want it.
Yeah.
Plus, back when they had the armed revolution the last time, people were allowed to have guns.
Yeah. Well, don't give them up now.
So with all the negative trends we're seeing in our country today, do you believe things will get better or worse?
I think that it's up to us to answer the question. If I need a minimum of 300,000 people who agree with me, and we can fix the country. If I get 3 million, I guarantee you we can fix the country. And so it just means if I can find 3 million people, that's 1,000 people in 3,000 state legislative districts, I guarantee you I can fix the country with 1,000 people in 3,000 state legislative districts. We've got the plan in place. We know how to do it. We've got the political experience. We've got the legal know-how. We've got funding. We've got everything. I just need 3 million people, really someplace between 300,000 people, because 100 in every legislative district might actually do the trick. But 1,000, I guarantee you, will do the trick. So someplace between 300,000 people who believe in the future of this country and 3 million people who believe in the future of this country can fix it. I don't need 150 million. I don't need 170 million. I need 3 million people. And if I can find 3 million people who are willing to try what the Founding Fathers told us to do and have enough hope in this country and belief in the Founding Fathers and belief in the Constitution and belief in freedom and belief that they, the people, know better than Washington, D.C. does, I guarantee you we can fix this. And so I have hope because I think I can find 3 million. If I had to find 200 million, I don't have hope. I don't need 200 million. I need 3 million because it's really simple. If one state legislator gets 1,000 calls telling him, I want a convention of the states, he's going to vote for a convention of the states. It's as simple as that. And because they don't get 1,000 calls on anything at the state legislative level. And so if we can deliver that, if we can deliver something between 100 and 1,000 calls in 75% of the legislative districts of this country, we can turn it around. We can flat out turn it around. And that's what we need to do.
Okay. So is there any message you want to give our listeners today that you want them to take home? Give us your website and tell us.
Yeah. I want them to join me, and I want them to help me take back this country. And it's www.conventionofstates.com. And you can sign up there. You can sign up to be, you know, a grassroots supporter who says, I will call my senator, my state senator, my state legislators. And you also can be like a district captain. And we have many of our state leaders' positions filled, but if there's a few still left, and so if people wanted to be a state coordinator, we have a few spots there. We've got a lot of those filled already, but we've only been at this just a little over 3 months, and we've got a good start on the superstructure that we need to be able to build that network of 300,000 to 3 million people to turn this country around. And if we can get that, I mean, there's one Tea Party group alone that has 4 million people on its Facebook page. So 3 million, that's doable. On the HSLDA sites that I started, we've got 300,000 families. Well, 300,000 families is, you know, more than a million people. And so we just need to get 300,000 to 3 million people. That framework, we can make it happen. So if some of those people are listening to this radio show today and go to the website and sign up, we can win the freedom of this country back.
And if people have more questions about it, can they get answers from your website?
Absolutely. We have all kinds of stuff, and they can email us, they can call us, and we will help them. But there's a ton of information there. There are videos, there are booklets, there are short answers, there are long answers. There's all imaginable kind of stuff, and we're adding to it daily.
Speak to us as a Baptist minister for 1 minute. What do you want to, I mean, you've been ordained since 83. How has that impacted what you're doing, and how does that give you hope for the country?
Well, let me be a little provocative here and speak as the pastor to the congregation that's listening here. The book of James says, for him who knows to do right and doeth it not, to him it is sin. Now, do you think it's right, I'm talking to your listener, do you think it's right to try to preserve the freedom of this country? And this, if you do, are you going to do something about it? I've given you a very practical, reasonable, effective way to save the liberty of this country. For him who knows to do right and doeth it not, to him is sin. I am hopeful all the time because of my faith. It's really not because I'm a Baptist pastor, but it's because I'm saved by the blood of Jesus, and I see him working in my life and see him working in the lives of other people. And I have seen God deliver miracles in the political context time after time over the last 30 years. And so I am not worried about anything in the long run, because ultimately God is in control of these things, and he expects an enormous amount of responsibility from us. But if we stay true to God, his power is way more than enough. I've won cases I shouldn't have won. I had a judge tell me, you're going to lose today, and God intervened in a way that it takes too long to explain the story. But there's no doubt that God intervened in the story, and we won that case, despite the judge in front of the other attorneys told me, you're going to lose today. And so I've seen God deliver in legislative battles, in media, all kinds of places. God's real, and God is big, and God is good. And I have faith that he will guide us to be a country again that honors him, honors freedom, and lets parents raise their kids in freedom and in the ability to raise their kids in the nurture and the admonition of the Lord.
That is a good word. Well, thank you, Michael, for joining us today. It has been a true pleasure and a delight. We've learned so much. Will you come back on our show again sometime?
Sure, I'd be happy to come back, Cynthia. Just name the time.
All right. Well, thank you, and thank all of you for joining us, too. This has been another edition of Homefront on Missouri Grassroots Radio. I'm Cynthia Davis, and hope you enjoyed our program. Please join us next week when we offer another infusion of truth, honesty, and solutions that will grow people bigger and shrink government smaller. Thank you for joining us. See you next week.